Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. It is about 2:45 in the morning on Monday morning, early Monday morning. I just finished writing the 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio running back chapter earlier on Sunday morning and early afternoon, probably about 12 hours ago. 134-page chapter. Quarterback chapter, probably around 85, 90 pages. Pretty normal. RSP scheduled still for April 1st to be available for download for those who purchase it. Remember, you also get a post-draft update that comes out no later than a week after the draft. I'll talk about that more in the future. But I want to talk about this running back class today. Thought I'd give you some thoughts, just like I did last week on quarterbacks. Thought I'd do the same thing with running backs. But, of course, the running back's a little different. And I think one of the reasons why is this was the most difficult RSP chapter that I've ever written. And I've been doing this since 2006. I mean, it was hard. I actually needed 4 extra days to write it. And as a result, I'm actually having to scramble to reformat my budget to get this thing done by April 1st. And to be frank, I'm a little afraid that I might not get it done on time, but I'm going to do my best that I can. I got a good night or a good afternoon sleep. The quarterback chapter was pretty easy in comparison. I was getting a good night's sleep pretty much every night, with the exception of a couple of nights. This one, I probably got about 4 hours sleep in 3 days. So it was kind of crazy. And I wondered why, before I get into why it is and about these running backs, I wondered if it was because I've moved twice in the past 4 months and that, but then I thought about the fact that really the moves were pretty easy and I got more research done than I ever had before in terms of studying games and studying players. And quarterback wasn't that difficult. It was just a little more work intensive because I was doing all of the charting. Part of the problem really is that because I watched more games than I ever have before, it meant that I had more information organized and I need to update my process for next year so that when I sit down to write this book in March, it isn't as difficult time-wise to organize everything. And I've certainly had some good friends and helpers of this project suggest that to me in the past, but I haven't been in a position to really do a lot with that in terms of being able to do anything actionable, but I think I'm in a position where next year that'll be the case. And when I say that, it's difficult to write, it's not because I don't know what to say when I write it. I mean, sometimes when I used to do magazine features, I'd have a lot of information, but figuring out how to parse that information out or how to start a story and make it a certain way was difficult. And kind of delivering more of a craft with that. It's a different type of writing in terms of how to tell the story. For me, it's simply the time it takes to format all of this information for people to read is what makes the RSP difficult, is that I have it all there, but I can't get it out fast enough within the timeline, or if it feels that way. There's not enough hours in the day or not enough hours where I can stay awake and actually write something coherent. So the move wasn't the problem. What I've come to realize is that this running back class as a whole was the most difficult class I've ever evaluated. And I have this wide receiver class coming up, as my buddy Josh Norris would say. But why was it difficult? I mean, I've had difficult individual decisions that have taken time. I mean, I remember one of the more difficult decisions I've ever had to make was on an individual player was Darren McFadden. Whether or not I was going to give him, I didn't like I had a very low grade on McFadden compared to everybody else. He was pretty much a consensus running back one for most people, and they thought he was going to be a generational talent. And I didn't think he was remotely that. And I had a difficult time with that because it was new. My process was still new. I wondered whether or not I was missing something with him. And what I came to learn is that I hit on Darren McFadden. I was right for the reasons why he wasn't successful. But I also learned something in the process in terms of understanding the value of certain players fitting schemes, and that, you know, McFadden would be a better gap runner than he was a zone runner. And, you know, when he had that final good season in Dallas, that was one of the big criticisms on with him, was that as good as that line was, he still missed a lot of opportunities because he just wasn't comfortable in a zone scheme. Bishop Sankey was a tough one too, you know, and both of those guys I had lower than the norm, and it turned out they were. And Nick Chubb, obviously last year, having him as graded as high as I did, knowing full well that Saquon Barkley was a great talent and, you know, was earned one of the two highest grades I've ever given a back. So the fact that I had Nick Chubb in that area and even slightly above, I mean, by the smallest of margin, you know, that's difficult because you have to follow your process, and there's not much play with that process if you're staying true to that, you know. And so you understand that you're going to, I'm not immune to seeing what goes on around me and what's being said about players. And you wondered, what did I miss? Did I miss something? And you check and double check, and you watch the film again. And sometimes you're worried that if you watch it too much, you're going to develop a certain level of bias. So it's really great. The great thing about having the RSP, the way it's set up, is I've written things down how I've defined it. So ultimately, you know, I have to do what I have to do with that. And then it allows me to stick to my grades or stick to my guns with players a little bit more than some people maybe can, because they have much more variation in how they evaluate and things aren't as well defined. And sometimes that can allow bias to kick in for them. But what I found is that for me, it may be harder because I'm facing decisions that go against bias, you know, go against my own personal biases, that go against, you know, maybe my intuition on certain things, go against generally held beliefs that people have. But in the long run, it makes it easier because usually I found on the whole that when I stick to the evaluation, and I do, I've always have, but when I stick to it, and in the areas where there's no play, I'm making sure that I'm, you know, just reminding myself all the time to look at what the criteria says and to make sure that I've graded accordingly. It turns out 2 to 3 years down the line, more often than not, that the hard decisions turned out to be some of the better decisions. So what made this class difficult as a whole? Well, a good example is that, you know, I graded 70 running backs, and we're going to get to that in a little bit later because most NFL teams don't grade a fraction of that. Okay. And I'll tell you why in a little bit. But of those 70 running backs, if we were just to look at the number nine back and the 21st back on my list, in my final ranking, 1 point separated 13 of those running backs, 1 point on my depth of talent scale. Now, my depth of talent scale is a 100-point scale, and I came up with that scale because when I look at the NFL scouting reports, they rank players on a 0 to 9. I believe it's a 0 to 9 scale, and that scale basically is defined in very vague terms, kind of like all-pro player or franchise player, you know, start, you know, capable starter, rotational starter, you know, contributor, reserve, free agent, end of roster player, things like that. And they give you a little bit of an explanation of a gist of what that is. But that's vague when it comes to actually grading a player. It's kind of like employee evaluations. It's the same thing as like if you worked in corporate America and you had to ever give an employee evaluation. I used to have to give them all the time. And usually what would happen is it would be on a similar scale. The one that I worked, company that I worked at for a number of years, where I had to do them 0 to 7. And the unwritten rule was no one ever really got a 7. No one ever got any, no one really got a 6 or a 7. No one really got a 1 or a 2 or a, yeah. And And the reason was, is that if you're going to give a 6 or a 7, that person was probably going to get a promotion, and it was justification for that promotion. So they reserved those scores for that. Now, I'm saying that's unofficial. No one really said that, but you kind of get a feel for it when you start doing these, because if you give a grade that's higher, you're going to get pushback, and then you come to realize what the unwritten rule is. Same thing with, you know, 1 or 2. Usually that person's about to be out the door if you're giving them something like that. So you're really working, suddenly you've cut off the evaluation and you're only really working with ranges 3 to 5. Or and oftentimes what ends up happening is that if you have a difficult evaluation, you end up splitting the difference, you know, or people end up doing that if they are not very clear and detailed about how they evaluate people. And oftentimes evaluations come and, you know, they take a week or a couple weeks to do, or 3 weeks to do, and you're rushing to get them done. And sometimes, you know, someone who isn't good at evaluating ends up rushing to get these things done, and they're not really taking the time, or they don't have criteria to really assess how good or how well their employee performed. It depends on what type of environment you're in. You know, obviously there are certain environments where, you know, you can look at the data and be very clear, but then you're still talking about how well they perform in terms of leadership, you know, teamwork, interpersonal skills that are important in terms of being able to get the job done. So when you look at like the NFL scale, the same problems can occur where you look at the way it's not very well defined, and it becomes easy to kind of do things like, well, I really like the player, but I know that the organization I work for is probably not going to value him because he's not fast. So I'm going to give him a 3rd or 4th round grade when I actually, if I evaluated him according to the criteria I did and stuck with that, he'd probably be a 2nd or 1st round pick in my grading system. And you see that in the NFL where a lot of times round 4 grades are guys that either people know that the consensus buzz on them is really strong, but they don't like them, so they rate them lower. And the 4th round grade is that, even though they might have a very low, much lower grade on them, or they're really high on the guy, but they're afraid to stick to their guns with it. So, you know, there's a lot of room for play with that type of system. I don't have that. So when you look at the fact that I had 1 point separating the 9th to the 21st spot, it seems kind of crazy. But because on an intuitive level, when you look at 1 point on a 100-point scale, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of difference between those players. But really, when you start to break down how the evaluation works, that's true and it isn't true at the same time. Because when you break down positions into buckets the way I do and define them in detail and then grade by that detail, you begin to realize that a player's game has such a wide range of parts that, and they're combined in all sorts of different ways of expression. It's like looking at snowflakes. Each one's very different. Each one's unique in that sense. They're similar, but then when you look at, really examine them under a microscope, they're amazingly different. And that's what it's like to evaluate players. So for instance, in this class, you know, there's 2 players with the same grade that are expressing that grade in vastly different ways, Justice Hill and Benny Snell. On my depth of talent scoring rankings, they have the same grade, but their grades are incredibly different. When you look at Hill, and he's a very quick, explosive, quick twitch, you know, make you miss player who's going to be used a lot out of the backfield, who's going to be run on draw plays, who you're going to run toss to. You may want to have him run gap plays a lot. He's someone that you can, you know, who would probably be best expressed in terms of his game in a pistol set or a shotgun set, or you even put him in the slot eventually and use him split from the formation, and he could take it to the house or at least flip the field for you on any given play. But Benny Snell, you look at him and He's a classic banger. If you could put him in the I formation or a single back set, two tight ends, and let him run downhill, you know, he's someone that's going to be able to, you know, press, and he's patient. He's going to be able to press and cut back and get downhill and run through wraps. He's going to push a pile. He's going to be able to break tackles, and he's going to gain, you know, 8 to 12 yards on a good play. Whereas Justice Hill might gain 50 to 60 yards on one of his good plays, you know. But Benny Snell's also the type of guy that you can often count on to get you the 2 or 3 hard yards, whereas Justice Hill, sometimes you might be afraid that he's going to lose 7 to 8 because he doesn't want to settle for those 2 to 3 hard yards, or that Justice Hill's going to wear out his offensive line a little bit, reversing field and dancing around and trying to create. Whereas with Benny Snell, you know that he's pretty much going to run up the backs of his linemen if nothing's there and just generate a push. Very different players. And you can see same grade because the combination of elements that they express well or not so well just happen to add up to the same score. Now, it both tells you that they're good to a certain level, but the way that that is expressed is different. And this is why NFL teams filter their positions. You know, they filter it down to far fewer plays. And I've studied for the RSPM. And like I said, I studied 70 running backs this year and ranked them in order. Realistically, if I were part of a team or working for a team as a consultant, they would be asking me to look at 8 to 10 backs or maybe even 5 to 7 backs, no more. And all those players would be similar skill sets. If they had me looking at Benny Snell, they'd also have me looking at Divine Ozigbo or Alex Barnes or Jordan Scarlett or LJ Scott or, you know, Josh Jacobs. They would be having me look at those types of players. If they have me looking at Hill, you know, then they're going to have me looking at guys like Hill in terms of the function, role, athletic components. And maybe there'd be some intersection between certain players, but you would have a very clear idea of what the team's looking for there. So for me, the fact that they had similar skill set, you know, have very different skill sets and express the same, or they have the depth of talent is the same, but they're expressed very differently. That's a difficult aspect too, you know, because you want to ensure that when you look at that grade, you can explain what it is and, you know, where their value comes from, where their potential is. But then there's another issue. And this is what was really the root issue with this class that was so tough. It's the way this class of backs expresses their games individually. This class has greater potential to be a minefield for NFL teams and especially fantasy players than I've ever seen. I mean, this is a dangerous class. I'm scared of this class, to be honest with you. There are a few really safe players, you know, but the meat of this class, the guys that are going to get picked, you know, in the second, third, fifth, seventh round, there's some guys in this range that are going to get opportunities that, you know, they could either be really good or they're going to be out of the league quickly. And it's, you could say, well, that happens every year, but the reasons why is what makes this so compelling and such a minefield, because many of these backs receiving the buzz they've received have the oddest combination of parts that comprise their total games that I've ever seen. You know, the way I would express this is that there are a lot of players where I've wondered, is their game greater than the sum of their parts or less than the sum of their parts? So let's talk about some of these backs that fit this example. Are they greater than the sum of their parts or are they less than the sum of their parts? Let's start with Miles Sanders. He's a good example of one. You look at him and certainly, you know, played very well after Saquon Barkley left, and you can see that, you know, he has that quickness you're looking for. He's fast enough. You know, physically, he's good enough to be an NFL starter. No doubt about that. You know, but he has to learn how to play his own game. You know, you watch his tape, and you see a player that when he's just kind of makes the quick decision, you know, follows the blocks, hits it, and with, you know, hits the creases, he's very good. And then he can be creative in the open field. But when he tries too hard to be what his predecessor was, you know, he's not Saquon Barkley. And I think that he was influenced by Saquon Barkley because, of course, he watched him for a few years and worked with him for a few years. And Barkley, while Sanders is a very good athlete, I mean, seriously, 20 bench press, 36 vertical leap, his three cone is better than Barkley's. His 20 shuttle is better than Barkley's. But he's also, you know, about 20 pounds, 25 pounds lighter than Saquon Barkley. And, you know, so when you look at it from that perspective, what Barkley could do from a size, speed, quickness, explosion context is different than Sanders, who is, an average-sized NFL starter, you know, at the 211-pound mark, maybe even slightly below average, you know, thinking 215, 220. So he, you know, he's trying to be a little something that maybe Barkley can get away with because his Barkley's contact balance is going to be a little better with his quickness. And while Sanders is a little quicker, you know, it's also about the way that you piece that together. So the context of that quickness, which is how creatively is it expressed? And I think that Sanders, you know, you watch him and he can try a little too hard to make that extra move. He can be, you know, the creativity and intuitive problem solving of avoiding tackles isn't on the same level as Barkley. And even Barkley has some issues that I've certainly written about where, you know, obviously he's a terrific back, but even, you know, even when he's having to create, there are times that he can push the envelope too far. So Sanders is interesting because, you know, he could be a lead back. He might wind up a passing down back, but then you have a fatal flaw with him, which is his ball security is horrific. He's averaged a fumble, I think, about every 60 touches, somewhere in that range, which when I tier that ball security rate into, you know, actionable, you know, what caliber level of tier is he in, that's near the lowest tier. It's just on the cusp between reserve and basically being a street free agent, you know. And when you think about players who fumble the ball, David Wilson, great athlete. I would say David Wilson was a more exciting, you know, seemed like a close to a can't miss runner than Miles Sanders is. And he couldn't hold on to the football. You know, you can say, well, that's Tom Coughlin. He's harsh. But Bill Belichick had Stevon Ridley, who wasn't nearly as good of an athlete as Miles Sanders, I think. And you look at his career, and he's bounced around a ton since having one good season with Belichick and then fumbling it away. And here he was in Pittsburgh last year, starting to have a good game. And what did he do? Fumbled the ball away. It can get into your head. So I've had people ask me, they'll say, what, you know, why do you place so much emphasis on ball security? And the reason for me is that some coaches, the way they handle it, may be a little bit more moderate in their views and they'll deal with the fumbles. But usually it's because the player is an absolute superstar. Adrian Peterson, I think, had 20 fumbles during his first 2 years, which was a reason why I also had Marshawn Lynch slightly above him, even recognizing that Peterson could be like an Earl Campbell, Walter Payton, LaDainian Tomlinson type of generational back. But knowing that fumbling could have been an issue, if he were with Tom Coughlin, Would Tom Coughlin have benched him? We don't know. You know, Peterson got benched for a series, and then put back in the game and then continued fumbling until he figured it out. David Wilson kept getting benched until, pretty much didn't work out for him. Injury was part of it too, but, he fumbled and there was a harsher punishment. So Sanders could risk that. And he's not the type of athlete that you look at or the generational type of running back where you can look at him and say he's going to be able to get away with that. What about Elijah Holyfield? Elijah Holyfield, you look at his game, and everyone was excited about him from, when you look at the surface level, broad view of analysts who are on TV, the talking heads to the casual fans. Elijah Holyfield, he's at running back U, or arguably running back U right now. Todd Gurley, Nick Chubb, Sony Michel, and now here's Elijah Holyfield. DeAndre Swift, who's, played with him, is going to be an even better prospect, if you ask me. He's going to be on the level of probably those three other backs that preceded Holyfield. But Holyfield, he goes and runs a 4.78 at the combine. Is that right? Yeah, 4.78 40. That got people worried. The 29.5 vertical, that also further worried people. Because you're like, he's not that explosive. He's not that, he doesn't have long speed. And it was shocking to a lot of people. Now, if you've watched him enough, you realize that he was going to be slow. Because you could see that he could get into the secondary, but he couldn't separate. That he could get around the corner, but he wasn't going to be able to completely turn up field and get a ton of yards unless the way the defense was aligned, that the cornerbacks and safeties had to catch up. Linebackers were going to be able to chase him down if they have NFL level athletic ability. So what you see with Holyfield is he's strong, and I wouldn't say he's like unbelievably strong. People say that and they look at him and they have that blown up picture that wasn't true of him practicing at Georgia, where they kind of Hulk smashed his arms and everything. He's 5'10", 217. Which is a pretty average size back, for a starter. Good size, but it's, you're not looking at something extraordinary. He's not Adrian Peterson. He's not 230, 235, 225 even. And 8 pounds makes a difference. But he's a guy who's quick enough to get through the crease, but he's a guy that he will lower his pads and attack a safety and create a push. He'll attack a linebacker and create a push. That's what you expect from a running back. Is he going to run through defensive linemen on a regular basis? No. Now, somebody will probably listen to me say that and find one or two plays during his career in the NFL and say, see, he did it. I'll say, great. Congratulations. You found the four-leaf clover in the clover patch. Now, go find 20 of them for me, okay? And then we can get to talking about the prevalence of four-leaf clovers in the same clover patch. But Holyfield is a good player, but what I fear about him is because he doesn't have that long speed, teams will look at him and go, well, yeah, he can get me those 8 to 12-yard gains. He might break off a 15 to 25-yard gain. He's going to be able to help wear down a defense. He can catch. He's a starter-caliber player. But he reminds me of Travis Henry. Remember Travis Henry? Travis Henry's a little smaller, probably not quite as quick, but he didn't have the speed either. But Travis Henry was often described, his running style was described as a bowling ball with knives coming out of it. And Elijah Holyfield has a little bit of that to his game. But when you think about Travis Henry, he started for the Bills for a little bit. He started for the Broncos for a little bit. He started for the Titans for a little bit. But he never really stuck around anywhere. And, some people will cite things that have nothing to do with football with that. But really the answer is Travis Henry didn't have deep speed. And eventually teams want a player who can be a complete back, or they want the hope of that. and they don't want to pay a guy that kind of money if he doesn't have that full expression of talent potential in terms of his athletic ability. If he can't stretch the defense and be a game breaker, why are we going to pay him game breaker money? That's often the negotiation tactic that you're going to see between, you know, GMs and owners and agents of those players. I mean, look at CJ Anderson. Look how well he played last year at the end of the, and he was overweight. John Elway didn't want to pay him. Well, if you look at the backs that they had, arguably CJ Anderson, there's no contest between him and Devontae Booker, but they were trying to force Devontae Booker into that equation because they didn't want to pay CJ Anderson. They also saw Booker as a potential talent that would fit, but they even changed the scheme to favor what Booker did better because he struggled his first year. And Anderson played in that scheme better, even though than Booker did, and that wasn't even the strength of CJ Anderson's game. They used a gap-heavy scheme instead of a zone one. CJ Anderson's naturally a zone runner. They put him in gap because Booker isn't very good in zone, and Booker still faltered in gap compared to what CJ Anderson did. Then they just got rid of Anderson. So you look at those scenarios, and I worry that teams are going to look at Elijah Holyfield the way they looked at CJ Anderson, the way they look at Travis Henry. Good enough for us to use when we need a back. But do we really want to pay him to be the man, even though arguably he's demonstrated that he can be? That's my concern about his career and what may happen with him. Let's look at a guy who's maybe not high on the list. Kadri Olofsson out of Pittsburgh. You know, he's what, about 6'1", 225, ran a pretty good 40 and like below 4.6, you know, but doesn't have great acceleration, doesn't have great, change of direction speed in the metrics. But then you watch his games and you're like, he's pretty fluid. He can run he can manage all different types of cuts, parallel cuts, jump cuts. He can open his hips and make the sharp turn and efficiently work away from penetration. Seems to be able to get the edge on a certain types of plays. You know, he can make the first man miss when he cuts downhill. And he's had some runs where I watch him and he's holding off cornerbacks and safeties. You know, and there are plays where you wouldn't expect that from his time. But he was able to do it on the field. And it was quality competition. You know, could he be an Arian Foster type of player whose you know, metrics aren't that great, but his ability to play the game and how fluid that he expresses the skills that he has outweighs the times. Because when we talk about the sum being greater than its parts, that's one of these examples, is that you can be quick or fast in an exercise, but can you fluidly anticipate what you need to do on the field based on what's coming at you? And some players think slow, some players think fast. I think Kadri Olofsson's a fast thinker, and I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up making a roster, and when he does get on the field, he expresses his talent better than his times appear. I don't know if that means he's going to turn out to be, you know, a starter one day. I wouldn't bet on that. But at the same time, I wouldn't count out that he plays fairly well. So that's kind of a difficult evaluation in terms of, is he more or less in his game? Travis Homer. Listen, I have Travis Homer is not even my top 20 in my depth of talent. I'll give you that little, you know, spoiler right there. But I also score backs with a different depth of talent based on what I call third down skill or passing game skill. Because we're seeing in the league that you've got the Hill versus Snell argument where they had the same score, but they're very different expression. Homer's more in the Hill territory than he is in the Snell territory. So when I sort my grades of depth of talent and use my third down depth of talent score, which has more emphasis on passing down skills and skills in open space as opposed to skills between the tackles, and I've adjusted my scoring for those types of things, Travis Homer is a top five back. Very different, right? Very different expression. Not even in my top 20, if you're looking at, you know, this from a broad standpoint. But if I look at it strictly on third down, he's one of the top backs. And what's funny about him is that when it, and I like how I've scored this, because I wish I had this for Alvin Kamara. I really do. Because I think that that would have really sold it for me on a different level. Even though I had him high in that grading, the way that I've updated these gradings now, learning from Kamara and learning from other players, you know, I look at Homer and I go, okay, if you put this guy in the right context, he could be really interesting. You know, you use him a lot in space, he could have some high production upside for you. Watching him as a receiver is a good example. Needs to work on routes. If he could run routes like a wide receiver or even approximate that, wow. Because the way he catches the ball, he's got great hand-eye coordination. He adjusts so well to the football. He adjusts like a wide receiver. He's got wide receiver like speed. You know, he's someone that you can send on intermediate and deep routes that are more linear routes, like seam routes, maybe a corner route, you know, wheel routes, bullet routes, that type of thing. But and then he's a pretty tough runner in the open field. He's a physically intense player, but he has a lot of technical things to learn. And some of those technical things that he has to learn may also have to be combined with some conceptual understandings of the game. And, you know, without giving all of that away, I do have concerns whether or not he's going to be able to accumulate enough of these techniques to end up, you know, playing to his potential. But that's the interesting thing. Again, you know, when you look at him, that's why teams don't grade. He's a perfect example of why teams don't grade backs all on the same scale. The running back is a different position depending on how it's expressed. He's more on the Justice Hill school than he is on the Snell school. And when you look at the Hill school and you grade it, you know, third down skills based on depth of talent there, he was much higher of a grade than he was when I just looked at it as an expression of a variety of skills in the way that I'd look for a feature back. So like my normal depth of talent is really a grade of how good of a feature back that player can become. My third down skill is more of how good of a space player, specialty player, can that guy be in terms of, you know, from that side of the expression. So then we come to Jordan Scarlett. Good old Jordan Scarlett out of Florida. Listen, this guy is interesting to me because, you know, you look at him up close and you go, he's a really in shape dude, you know, very sculpted, takes care of his body. You look at him on tape a little bit further away and you just look at the whole of his frame and you'd say, he's not especially big. You know, I mean, he's close to, you know, the average size that you're looking. He's 208 pounds, 5'11", 208. I look at that and I go, he might be well-defined. He might be in really good shape. He may be strong for his size, but he's not very big. And when you look at him, he kind of looks like a string bean version of a running back when he's in the middle of a, you know, line of scrimmage. But man, the effort that he plays with, the number of wraps and hits he bounces off of and runs through. He is a strong player and relentless player in terms of, you know, if you can't get a hit and a wrap on him, it's hard to bring that guy down. So I love that effort. He reminds me a little bit of John Kelly in that sense. But he's an odd expression too. You know, you look at his speed and it's just under 4.5. So you get him in the secondary and you get him to give him a chance to build up that speed, and he's going to hold off cornerbacks and safeties for the most part for a good bit of time, good bit of distance. But he's not very quick. And he certainly doesn't have great acceleration. So how's he going to get to that point, you know, in the NFL? How's he going to get to that open field to where he can build up that speed? How often is that really going to happen? And is he quick enough? And does he have enough acceleration for him to actually even just hang in the NFL? I actually have real questions about that. And as you know, and what I've talked about in previous podcasts, is that I just look for, you know, I'm looking at these combine numbers as bigger, stronger, faster isn't better necessarily. It's, can you ride the ride? And I do have some questions about whether Jordan Scarlett's going to be able to ride the ride in terms of basic acceleration and change of direction quickness. When I watch the tape, it looks pretty good. You know, I think he's going to be okay. But if I were looking solely at the combine data, I'd actually be worried. And there are players where I've looked at them and I've thought, oh, the tape's better than what the data is. And I think that the tape doesn't lie. But it does. You know, as Lance Zierlein mentioned on Twitter, the tape can lie. It can. Jamal Williams is a good example of that. I really liked Jamal Williams. And, you know, when I look at his game, what I realized is that he was just on the cusp of, you know, his he wasn't fast, but his acceleration and his three-cone quickness were more reserved tier. And I looked at the tape and I thought, that's not reserved tier tape, you know. And it turns out that while he's been able to hold his own against Aaron Jones and they've split time and he's had some really good efforts, he's more of a volume back. He's not as quick and not as explosive as I thought he would develop to be. You know, I thought that he might get a little more training in and develop and get a little faster. You see guys do that. Ray Rice did that. And I thought, add a little more weight, get a little more explosive. It's going to, that little area, those two areas where he's on the cusp of being a reserve or a committee back, and now he'll be more committee and more starter. His total game will be able to express that in a way where he's going to be productive and he's going to be quick enough in situations where I've looked at him in Green Bay and said, he can break tackles, he can catch the ball, he's a great blocker. He can make the first or second man miss in certain ways. But when he gets into that next crease, you know, he's not able to really get through that crease at the level that you would need to see. Not the way, say, Aaron Jones can. You know, I never expect him to be as quick as Aaron Jones, but at least quick enough. So, you know, that's a lesson learned. And when you look at that, you know, that type of thing, I wonder if Jordan Scarlett's going to be able to do that even as well as Jamal Charles. And I think the answer is, I don't think he will. You know, I think it's going to be very close. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Darrell Henderson. You know, Darrell Henderson, I mean, you look at his game and you're just like, watch him, and he's so fat, he's so explosive. You get him into the basically the level with linebackers, and you might as well expect that he's going to wind up at least 15 yards behind that in a given play. He's, you know, people look at him and I think he's a classically difficult evaluation because he is a certain archetype of running back. And stay tuned for that in the RSP. In the Darrell Henderson section, I reveal some of the archetypes for players at that position. They're physical stylistic archetypes that I've been working on. And I've revealed kind of a rough version of five of them and how he fits into that. But his archetype is one that fits what you'd see with a player like Dalvin Cook. And the big problem we had with Dalvin Cook in this draft community, if you were going to say we as a collective, I like Dalvin Cook. But the problem was he doesn't cut really well. He doesn't have all those, you know, fancy jump cuts, and he's not, you know, he doesn't have a great vertical leap, and he's, you know, he's not extraordinary, you know, his agility numbers, you know, three cone type of, you know, drills. Stop start isn't all that great. You know, is he really going to be good? Because running backs need to, you know, have this certain type of metrics that one size fits all. All backs are different. And I think the archetype is part of that, that you really got to start to key in on. And I'm going to be doing more and more of that as I continue my career. And when you look at Dalvin Cook, he's a guy that he has what's called good curvilinear movement. and you're going to read a lot about a little bit about curvilinear movement. Sean Miska, I believe, is the, I think I've given, pronounced his last name correctly, but he's a movement specialist, works with NFL players like Everson Griffith. Okay. And curvilinear movement is really about, you know, a line, you know, a curve, like the motion of a curve, and how fast can you run or bend a run into a curve without losing acceleration. You know, players with good curvilinear movement can maintain a nice speed in that fashion. And Dalvin Cook's very good at that. Darrell Henderson is also very good at that. So I look at Henderson and, you know, the questions with him are, Rant faced a lot of nickel defenses. He spread the field a lot. You put him in that kind of a defense or that kind of an offense, you know, he's going to face more nickel, and defenses are playing base nickel now in the NFL. That might as well be their base defense. So I'm not really concerned about Henderson being productive. I'm just more concerned about how much he's going to be used and will he be the focal point of that offense. I think he will, and I think he could wind up being one of the better backs. If he's used as a receiver and used as the offensive focal point, he could be one of the most productive backs in this class. He might even be the most productive back in this class. But if you grade him on the level of a traditional feature back, and there are, and, you know, half to two-thirds of the teams might want him to express in that range, he's not the top back. He's going to be a boom-bust player for you. And so that's problematic. That was a difficult one. Alex Barnes. Man, you look at the combine, you look at the 4.120 shuttle at 226 pounds. I mean, Nick Chubb and Saquon Barkley were like at 4.24, 4.27. Alex Barnes is at 4.1 at nearly the same weight. You know, at least nearly the same weight as Chubb, a pound difference. Barkley, maybe 5 pounds lighter. 6.953 cone drill. It's fantastic. That's like wide receiver change of direction quickness. 38.5 vertical, strong, explosive legs. This guy is going to be able to execute some really dynamic cuts for you, think, right? 34 bench press. Strong upper body. I mean, combine, he killed the combine for the most part. 4.59 40, yeah, okay. Good enough. I mean, certainly, you look at all this quickness and you look at everything there and you'd say, that kind of suits like what Arian Foster did well. Great change of direction, strong, good acceleration, fast enough to at least hold on to the separation he got in the first 20 yards over the course of another 20 yards, right? That's kind of how I look at it, is think of the 20 as how fast is he in, you know, being able to change direction and get through the line in that first 20 yards? How much separation can he create there? Then the 40 is how long can he hold it over the next 20 to 40 yards after that first wave? You know, Barnes isn't going to be able to, you know, he doesn't hold it as well, hold that speed as well as he does initiate it. Fine. It's all right. That's still good enough for a guy to be a feature back. And he can catch. He can catch the ball really well. But then you look at his game, and there are things with his game. You watch his tape, and it's like he gets into the secondary, and he slows down. Or he loses that. He loses that rate of that pace of running. He loses it very fast. People catch up very fast. And when he sees them, you actually see him kind of lean into the contact, and not in an aggressive or explosive way, or lean away and almost fall to the ground before he's even contacted, or at least give up his resistance. And that's odd, you know? So I worry about him because I wonder if his game really is the sum of their parts. He's got great parts, and there are certain parts of his game, like use him as a receiver. I'd love that. Situational receiver with the power and the speed, can keep him in the open field. Pretty darn good. It's not that he's a bad between the tackles runner, but he doesn't express his traits at the level in a way that you would expect. So kind of, you know, he's a guy that I could see growing and becoming a feature back, but I can also see the downside with him. And because the film doesn't really, it shows him not really expressing those talents well enough. And I have concerns about that. Then there's a guy on the opposite of the scale, LJ Scott, who I actually have graded higher than Barnes, who, I mean, his times are pretty average, you know, maybe a little below average. You watch how he expresses his game, though, and you can tell he's quick enough, or at least I think he will be. And that's, again, the little risk with that. But I think that, you know, even with me grading strictly to what, you know, to the criteria I have, I see a guy who can give you what James Conner gave the Steelers, you know, and, you know, strength, ability to make the first man miss, and, you know, either in the backfield or in the hole, being able to make a second cut, catching, you know, out of the backfield, being able to be split from the formation and catch the football. Very polished player with some strength. But again, will he get to express that? Will his draft capital be high enough because of the fact that he isn't a great athlete in terms of explosion? Then we get to our last two here, Travion Williams and Devin Singletary, probably two of the harder players I've ever had to evaluate. On the one end with Williams, he's had great production, and I think a lot of people, especially in the analytics community, they often use production as a predictor or as a correlator to talent, or at least to a correlator to these guys being able to produce in the NFL. And I think sometimes certain production metrics, what they end up doing is they feed into the bias of NFL decision makers that give them the draft opportunity. And when you get more opportunities to succeed and more opportunities to fail before they actually, you know, decide to do away with your role, if you're in a small subset of a position that's good enough to even be considered for the draft, you're usually talented enough to play. So you could be drafted in the first, second, third round based on your production and not be as good as a fifth, sixth, seventh round athlete at your same position, but you're going to get more opportunities to fail. You already have a bigger contract and investment, you know, supplied, you know, backing you. And as and you're going to perform and you perform decently with surrounding talent, great. I worry about that with Travion Williams. I look at him and I think he can catch. He can make the first man miss. He can make the second man miss at times, even though he's not nearly as quick as it looks. And I don't even think he looks that quick on film, to be honest. He's more often in open space, and that first make the first man miss, he can do that. But is he dynamic? Is he Devonta Freeman? I don't think he's on the level of Devonta Freeman. No. And the thing about Devonta Freeman is Devonta Freeman can run with contact balance. You have to have contact balance in the NFL to be a full-time back, some level of it. When I watch Travion Williams this year, and maybe he'll improve, but when I watch him, I've seen him get the ability to have a nice long runway, run up the flat, run through a crease, 7 to 10, 12, 15 yards, drop his pads into a cornerback sitting still, safety, standing still, and not be able to budge that cornerback and get dropped. That's subpar contact balance. You got the basic contact balance you want to look for. When you can make a direct collision with a defender, can you move him backwards and can you run through the defender? Can you be able to get 3 to 4 yards after that? Even 2 to 3 yards after that? Are you going to get stalemated and maybe get a yard or get pushed backwards or pulled backwards? And that happens to Williams a lot. He gets pulled backward, pushed backwards, stalemated in awkward, odd situations in ways that I remembered the same from Darren McFadden with his faulty pad level, watching him like run downhill and hit an LSU defensive back and not gain an inch, you know, as fast and as big as he was, you know, or at least, you know, the size level he was relative. I mean, he was considered a bigger back, though he really wasn't. He's probably not that much bigger than Williams when you really look at it. But that's my point, is that, well, he was a little bigger than Williams. But you look at the point is that the contact balance wasn't there. So I have concerns about that. I don't know if his physical game really holds up, even though he's so much improved as a blocker this year compared to last year. Last year, people loved his blocking, but what he really did is just throw his body around and try and hit people. Now he's actually technically sound, throwing good punches, staying in a position to follow up, being able to move his feet and maintain an area where he can continue to keep his hands on a man and direct him. Really admire the work that Travion Williams puts into his game. I just have concerns whether it'll be enough. I think teams are going to give him a shot. I really do. But he was a difficult evaluation because as much as I wanted to try and be open to how his skills could be expressed, you know, on a high level, and I think that they can be productive. You know, if I compare him to the lot here, even as a third down player, he doesn't match up as well as some of the other guys. So, you know, I think he's a bit overrated in this class. I think he can still be in the NFL and be in the league and be a contributor, but he's not a guy that I would look at and say he's a priority pick. Devin Singletary might be one of the more difficult players I've had to evaluate. Maybe the most difficult of this class because, you know, he's subpar heights, 5'7", 203, you know, so he's got decent weight, short, kind of that Tariq Glenn kind of thing, right? Or Tariq Cohen type of thing. Tariq Cohen, though, is a lot faster, a lot more explosive. Singletary is, you know, good enough with his acceleration. He's actually below average with his three-cone time, change of direction skills. And when I watch him closely, you can see that the way he changes direction isn't so much as how explosive he is. He can make a sharp turn and get downfield. He can use slow pace, fast pace to make it look really explosive. But he's not really like running at full speed one direction and then cutting in another and continuing at full speed and accelerating out of it. He's going slow in one direction, makes a sharp turn without a jump cut or maybe a little hop, and then begins to accelerate. But it's because he set the defenders up with the slower pace to begin with. I don't know if he's going to get away with that in the NFL. But what's interesting about him is that because he's so short, because he is just quick enough in terms of just a basic acceleration, that, and because he's got great vision, he has terrific vision. That might be the saving grace for his game. He has the best vision in this class. And when I say that, there's different ways of expressing vision. He has the best vision in his class in terms of the basic things you look for, but then added on top of that, that really makes it good, is his peripheral vision. He can see things on a very broad level and how they develop and incorporate that into how he paces a run, how he sets up defenders. And then because he presses so deep into the line and he's short, I start to think that maybe defenders lose track of him and can't find him with that press and cutback. So it affords him, when they lose him and can't see him, it affords him an extra step or two. Well, that translates to a quicker look. You know, if you give a guy with a four, you know, you give Alex Barnes, for instance, you know, and Devin Singletary, have them run the same three-cone drill, and probably Devin Singletary is 2 to 3 steps behind. But now suddenly, if you translate to the field and you see that the running back is the defensive backs or the linebackers or the linemen can't find Singletary and it takes 2 to 3 steps for them to locate him, suddenly, you know, they're on even playing field. Then you have the fact that Singletary's hard to get a hand on because he's small in terms of he's short and he runs compactly with really good pad level and lean. So he also makes it harder to get a direct hit on him. So suddenly the lack of great quickness is mitigated by his vision. His ability to catch him and hit him square is mitigated by his size. So can you see how the expression of a player's physical traits and how he expresses that into his game can be to his advantage? And maybe if you're looking at just the metrics of the situation, you may not be getting the complete picture. So when I look at Singletary, while I probably don't have him rated as highly as other people who are just rating by a number like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, he's not far away. Like if he's literally less than a point away from being a top 10 back. Okay. In my scoring. But he's a guy that I can see as being a lead back or a passing down back in this league. But I can also see where maybe his total game may not fit very well because is he going to be quick enough? Is he going to be able to change direction enough? Is he going to have enough acceleration? Can he break enough tackles? You know, I mean, he's did it a lot in the college level, but is he going to be able to do that in the NFL level? So it depends, again, where he goes. So you can see that's all these guys had really odd combinations of parts to their games. The best backs, you know, they all have one flaw that I think usually submerges the value of backs at the top of a board. I don't think, you know, they have a great deal of distance speed. So that's going to be interesting. So then you also have backs who haven't earned a lot of notoriety that I think could be notable contributors, if not focal points of the offense. You know, you have guys like Alexander Mattison, who I think is, I've talked about for a few months and really like his game. And I think that, you know, he has the acceleration and change of direction quickness and the vision, and he's a refined player, but is he going to have the draft capital because he's not, you know, he's not the fastest guy? You know, that's going to be interesting. He got a visit with the Chicago Bears, that tells you that they value him fairly high on their board. So that's interesting. Bruce Anderson is another small school guy. Didn't get a chance to really be to impress at the Senior Bowl. Catches the hell out of the football. Good speed. Physical guy. Where he goes is going to be interesting. A complete combine snub, Darwin Thompson. I've talked about Darwin Thompson for a couple of months. At least, I think he could be a special player in the NFL if he gets the right fit with the system, because he has that kind of, he's a different player than Darren Sproles and Tarik Cohen in terms of how he expresses his skills. He's unbelievably strong, and we're going to talk about him more, I'm sure, on other podcasts, but he's another one that's interesting. Then we have guys who I think can be sleepers, you know, and we'll talk more about some of those sleepers, but, you know, Nico Evans, Wesley Fields, John Hilleman, Divine Ozigbo, those are four guys right there that definitely graded higher than I thought they would if I just heard them by name, you know, based on their game. I think all of those guys could have a significant impact in a backfield. As either a lead back, a productive committee back, or maybe even an every down back. So, you know, these are guys that I may talk about a little bit more in future podcasts, but you can see this was a difficult class. And so, you know, I want to just thought it would be fun to kind of delve into that and explain why. For fantasy owners who are looking at this class, there's about three backs in this class that are safe. The rest really could be, it could end up being a really underratedly great class, or it could be one that completely just blows up. And it was a difficult class for me. And I think I can say, as someone who's been doing this for 15 years, if it was difficult for me, you know, there's a chance that I just completely screwed it up. That happens every year. That can be the case every year, but more likely it's a tough one. And I think that you're going to see that in terms of the variety of grades people are going to have for these players. So thanks again for listening to this podcast. If you enjoyed it, please rate and review or email me with feedback. If you didn't like it and you'd like to see something different or hear something different about it, you can write me at mattwaldmanrsp.com. You can always rate and review at iTunes. This podcast is also available on Stitcher, Google Play, Podbean, and also Blueberry. If you're new to it and you found this from somebody who recommended it to you. Again, RSP hopefully will be available April 1st. I think it will be. I'm going to get started on the tight end chapter actually in a few minutes here after I take a break. And again, thank you all for your support and have a good week ahead here.